In the depths of the Great Depression, an army of surveyors, engineers, and workers came to western Kentucky to the banks of the Lower Tennessee River to build a massive wall of concrete and steel. The Kentucky Dam would bring jobs, make the Tennessee River navigable year-round, provide electricity for the region, and offer a place where all could come to enjoy nature. Some saw a better, brighter future in the dam. Others saw it as the tombstone for their way of life. Either way, it is as much a marvel of technology and human endeavor today as it was when construction began 75 years ago. In the next hour, we'll travel back up the stream of time to hear how Kentucky Dam came to be from those who built it and those who work on it today, and how it brought not just electricity, but opportunity, creating power for the people. You're listening to Kentucky Dam, Power for the People, a production of WKMS News. I'm Todd Hatton. Across the Tennessee River, between Livingston and Marshall counties, Kentucky Dam stretches almost 8,500 feet, 28 football fields long. It's the largest hydroelectric dam in the Tennessee Valley Authority's six-state system, able to move over 1 million cubic feet of water per second through its 24 spillway gates. Kentucky Lake sits just above it. Area-wise, it's the largest man-made lake in the eastern U.S. and can store over 1.3 trillion gallons of water. Before the dam, the people who lived along the Lower Tennessee had to be ready for the worst. The work of an entire planting season could wither in a drought or wash away with the topsoil in a flood. Retired Kennebec County Agricultural Extension agent Ted Howard says the region's farming practices didn't help.
Some people thought that you had to work up a lot of soil in that small area where the corn would be germinating coming up on hill ground up and down. That didn't do anything but cause erosion. They were losing their land into the river, and the river didn't like it. It was stopping the rivers up to some extent. Water washing that dirt into streams would be a headache to the farmer to have his lands drained to where he could get it worked up in the spring and planted into the corn or whatever he was planting.
In 1995, the Lake Trigg County resident Thelbert Joyce described life beyond the farm along the Tennessee River.
If you just moved all of the electrical lines and the water lines and everything and took up all the blacktop roads in this country, wasn't nothing but dirt roads or either gravel roads, see? We didn't have nothing much about convenience.
The Jazz Age prosperity of the 1920s had, for the most part, roared right past the Tennessee River Valley. An anonymous farmer of the time quipped that when the Great Depression came to the region, nobody noticed. Kentucky historian and Murray State University history professor Dr. Dwayne Bolin explains why.
Our folks had been experiencing a Great Depression since just after World War I. There was a brief boom during the war years when the federal government was our chief consumer of farm produce. After the war, our age-old problem came back to haunt us, and that was overproduction. Farmers have always been too good at what they do. They produce too much, which brings farm prices down. 70 to 80% of workers worked on farms, and only about 50% of those farmers own their farms. And the other 50% were farm laborers working for somebody else. Plus, this area was very, very sparsely populated, one of the most sparsely populated areas in the state of Kentucky. In that time period, there were some areas along the Mississippi River Valley and along the Tennessee River Valley that were more populated, more densely populated at the time of Christopher Columbus than they were in the 1920s and 1930s.
Boland says the sparse manpower and a particularly vulnerable chief industry meant early 20th century Valley life often seemed stuck in the 19th.
Before the dam was built, there was no bridge over the Tennessee River. There was no bridge over the Cumberland River. There was no bridge over the Mississippi River. When Murray State University was founded in 1922, there was not a paved road in Callaway County. We were lucky enough to have a gravel road. So this was an island, very, very isolated. You can imagine even being more isolated than the mountains of eastern Kentucky. There was no electricity, no indoor plumbing. Even the towns, you know, very few of the towns had any indoor plumbing, any sewage systems. So this was a rural outpost.
Again, Ted Howard.
You had small farms, like 80 to 100 acres. And I think the reason for that was for you to produce enough to feed your family, and you didn't have refrigeration to help you. You had, of course, canning, the old-fashioned way of canning. And they had team plows. It took a good pair of mules or horses to turn over an acre a day. They were not farming, but probably 20%. It had to rest in pasture to keep it from washing even more.
Outside agriculture, Thelbert Joyce said there was another way to make a living.
A little moonshining. I was around a little of it. I've seen it done. I'll put it that way. Yeah.
In 1932, Americans elected Franklin Delano Roosevelt president of the United States. He brought in new ideas to deal with the faltering economy and low living standards in rural areas like the Tennessee Valley. In a federally produced 1944 film, Valley of the Tennessee, actor Frederick March takes up the story.
In May 1933, a new chapter was written in American public policy when the plan was brought before the representatives of the people in Congress. An act was passed creating the TVA, the Tennessee Valley Authority. President Roosevelt told the nation that the project would set an example of planning not for this generation alone, but for all the generations to come.
And the incident benefits will reach the entire nation.
This was the plan, to chain the river through a series of giant dams, checking the floods. Open it to navigation from its mouth to its headwaters. To give the farmers the benefit of modern science and research. To help them control the water on their land and restore the fertility of the soil. To reforest millions of acres on the ravaged hillsides. To exploit the mineral resources of the area. To use the electric power generated by the dams to develop and rehabilitate industry in the cities. To electrify the farms through rural cooperatives. Above all, to prove that human problems can be solved by reason, science, and education. The Tennessee Valley was to be pioneered again.
Actually, the idea of chaining the Tennessee River for navigation and flood control wasn't new in 1944. It went back to just after the Jackson Purchase in 1819, when Chickasaw land west of the Tennessee was opened to white settlement. Severe floods in 1913 gave the idea fresh urgency, but the U.S. government held off on action until after World War I. L.J. Horton came to western Kentucky in 1928 to teach journalism at Murray State Normal School and got involved in local efforts to build a dam nearby. 46 years later, Horton retired as head of Murray State University's journalism program. Before his death in 1992, Horton spoke about how the push for a dam began in earnest.
In 1920, the Congress of the United States instituted a 10-year survey of this whole valley. That's before the TVA was ever conceived of. And it's been described as one of the most comprehensive studies ever made of a valley and a resource. Then in 1928, the Army recommended that a dam be located at Aurora for navigation, flood control, and power development. And at that time, when that announcement came out, the press gave some notice to it. In our area, since Aurora was at the corner of Callaway and Marshall, Trigg over there, a lot of interest.
People in those counties formed Aurora Dam Clubs, which in turn made up the Lower Tennessee Valley Association, or LTVA. Men like Marshall County businessman Luther Draffen, 1st District U.S. Congressman Boris Gregory, and his brother Noble led the LTVA. They crisscrossed the region promoting what the dam could offer. In April and May of 1933, Congress debated, then passed the Tennessee Valley Authority Act. And on May 18th, FDR signed the agency into existence. Things began to move.
It was down in the valley that's called Tennessee. Uncle Sam started something in the year 33. We dreamed a great dream then that's now here to stay. Saw democracy's future when we built TVA.
TVA bought out private utility company permits for the Aurora Dam Project and studied the Corps of Engineer surveys. Then, nothing. Dr. Larry Bray is an economist with the University of Tennessee at Knoxville who worked for the Tennessee Valley Authority for 30 years. He explains the four reasons engineers didn't like the Aurora site.
The first one was when TVA examined the site, they found 100 feet of overburden of sand, gravel, and chert. They did some core drillings and thought that they could not economically remove all that stuff and keep it out of there while they were building a new lock. Secondly, TVA saw the need to build a sister dam on the Cumberland River. That would be at Barkley. If you're going to do that and dig a canal between the Tennessee and Cumberland Rivers, the dam had to be downstream of the canal for it to work. And you would use the canal to move water between the two reservoirs for flood storage and hydropower generation. The next reason was you wanted to get the dam as low as you could because you have tailwater issues at Kentucky. When TVA is not generating and at low times of the year, the tailwater gets too low that you can't get over the sill of the dam. That's the sill, is where the lock gates sit on the sill. TVA wanted to do as much flood storage as you possibly can do. And at mile 44.4, that's not a good place to do flood storage. So they wanted to get as low as they could and find a nice place to build the dam.
For electricity and rains that washed topsoil away in the night help turn the great turbines, turning dark into light.
Frustrated, the LTVA turned to Tennessee Senator Kenneth McKellar. He was a fierce TVA defender. People called him the agency's rich uncle, and he didn't hesitate to call Director A.E. Morgan and demand to know why construction hadn't started. But L.J. Horton said that phone calls from an irate McKellar were the least of Morgan's troubles at the end of 1935.
The TVA was challenged in constitutionality before the Supreme Court of the United States. And it was a close call. But the TVA was upheld, and this is their reasoning. That is, it's been decided since this country was here that navigable streams, the harbors and that the Congress had got power even across state lines. They wrote the decision. It said that you build dams to improve navigation. Mm-hmm. Nobody contests that. Now the question for the Supreme Court had to decide was, you build a dam, you can do one of two things. You can just build your dam, let the water run over it, or you can harness it and save that money and that electricity. So since you can build navigation dams, which is, nobody denies, it was rather stupid, they argued, that to say the government couldn't put generators in that dam. So you see how important navigation was.
Debate then moved on to just what this new dam would be. Navigation aid, flood control measure. Opponents knew they didn't want a dam that just generated power. L.J. Horton says 9 feet of water settled the issue.
So they had Congress put that in an act. And in 1935, Congress authorized TVA to build dams for a 9-foot channel from Paducah to Knoxville. Now that seems totally innocuous, doesn't it? Nobody could find fault with that. But it made possible Kentucky Dam.
In 1936, after 2.5 years of exploration, drilling, and surveying, Horton said the region was surveyed to death, the TVA finally submitted a report to Congress recommending Gilbertsville as the dam site.
But every time we could try to get them to authorize construction with appropriation, they would amend it, or change, I say they, Congress, powerful interests, would change it to preliminary investigation studies. And we would try to get that word construction, which was key. It's going to cost $117 million, which it did. And it was second highest price dam ever built at that time. It's the highest priced federal project ever in the purchase.
That price tag presented a high final hurdle for the dam, so the LTVA called upon Kentucky's most powerful political son for this final bit of heavy lifting. And in 1937, after the appropriation measure had made it through the House, Horton received a telegram, special delivery. It read, Washington, D.C., May 12th. Senate has just adopted our amendment for beginning construction at Gilbertsville Dam beginning next fiscal year. The message was signed, Alvin W. Barkley. When Kentucky Dam Power for the People returns, the real work begins. This is Kentucky Dam Power for the People. I'm Todd Hatton. Construction at Gilbertsville began July 1, 1938. The facilities used to build the dam first had to be built themselves, offices, machine shops, and a cement mixing plant. Crews also built access roads and housing for incoming workers. In late summer, TVA officials spread out across the region conducting worker examinations. In Murray, over 600 men turned out to take the test. Most came from area farms. Applicants who couldn't read or write were tested orally, and most had difficulty understanding the unfamiliar industrial terminology used in the examination. 25 years later, Benton, Kentucky native and Louisville Courier-Journal columnist Joe Creason wrote about a fellow Bentonian, not known for his intellect, who took the test. The very first question read, "What does hydrodynamics mean?" The man paused for a long time, then scribbled, "It means I don't get no job." Some, like Robert Moore of Marshall County, bypassed TVA altogether. It only cost him a few dollars.
I had a hard time getting a hard up there. I don't know how many times I went up where you couldn't hardly get in. And one day I told the wife, I said, "I'm going back to the dam this morning." And I walked up there, and they had a catwalk that walked across the dam to the powerhouse. I walked up to that catwalk, and there's a man standing there. I stopped and talked to him. He says, I was a hod carriers union. I says, well, I've worked for the railroad along to the union. And I says, I would like to have a job bad, need one. He said, tell you what you do. He says, you give me $10, I'll keep it for a week. If I don't give you a job, I'll give it back to you. In less than a week, I got a call.
Gradually, the workforce took shape, peaking at 4,861 by July of 1942. The man tapped to lead the project was George Jessup. TVA hired the New Yorker in 1934 to finish Wheeler and Gunnersville dams in Alabama. Then they sent him to Kentucky, where he served until the dam's completion. Most of Jessup's employees on the Kentucky project found him cold and distant. Marshall County native Charles Barrett went to work on the dam in 1940. He recalled Jessup's strict rules and how he had to skirt them one morning to get to work.
He was up in the penthouse on the old far side of the river. He had field glasses. He'd see every man on the job. And you had a badge. He could see who that man was. You had to have that badge to get in there to work every morning. I left mine at home one morning, and the badge is about the size of a Lucky Pack cigarette, same color and all. Well, you'd show it to the guard, your badge in the morning. I didn't smoke, and that's off my book. Cut that off that pack, stuck in that hand, showed him right there and went off.
Jessup was a study in contrasts. He was devoted to the project, but had nothing but contempt for TVA bureaucracy. He fiercely protected his workers' rights, but distrusted unions. Even in the office, Jessup showed two very different sides of himself. Paducan Zelma White worked as a secretary at the dam for a year. She remembers him as an intimidating figure.
We called him Pop, not to his face. Mr. Jessup was a bear. We were all scared to death of him. He was gruff. He came in frowning, and he'd walk through. He wouldn't speak unless he wanted to. Sometimes he'd speak, be very pleasant. Most of the time, he just went charging right through. His son said, he told someone, he said, Dad doesn't have any say about anything at home, so he has to be boss somewhere now. Isn't that ugly? I shouldn't tell that.
Mamie Evans was another of the secretaries, a transplant from Illinois. Evans worked in the project office from the beginning to the end. She recalls a very different Jessup.
A lot of people thought that he was awfully hard to get along with. But we had no transportation after we got out there. And on Friday afternoon, if I didn't have another ride, I would go up and say, Mr. Jessup, can I ride into Paducah to catch the bus home? Mm-hmm. And Mr. Jessup was always very nice to give me a ride, always teasing me about going to get married. I liked him.
George Jessup Jr. remembered his father as a hands-on manager, even if the workers didn't realize it.
At times, when he was running the job, he would go down and pick up a time check for a labor gang and go and spend an hour or so in that particular labor gang. In the process, he'd start talking to these guys about, well, what do you think of the old man? What's the old man like? After he got the mood of the workers and so forth and so on, and the way things were going, he'd go check his tag back in. Somebody had asked the foreman, well, who is that guy? I says, well, that was the old man.
Jessup was also a stickler for worker safety, but laborer Frank Dupree says the push to complete the project on time sometimes had unfortunate consequences.
It was snowing that night, and I was right on top of that dam. I looked at him and I said, I'm going to quit tonight. He said, why? I said, these roads are so bad, there's no way I could get down there hardly. And I can't climb up there and work down here. And I believe I'm going to stay with the fireman. And they put the man in my place next night. The equipment was working on Kilway somewhere or another, and he fell and killed. He said, killed him. Two years. And we went up the top down to the bottom. And swings on ropes and booms and everything else. I never got hurt. And then the very night I didn't come back, that poor man got killed.
12 men lost their lives building Kentucky Dam, but compared to other federal construction projects, the death toll was low. The much taller Hoover Dam cost 10 times more lives. George Jessup's rules and the breakneck speed of construction weren't the only things creating tensions. White and black workers were segregated on the job, in the unions, and in their living arrangements. That lack of contact made things worse, and matters came to a head in November 1940 when two separate incidents involving two black workers and the same white supervisor led to their firing and a three-day strike. It ended when officials reinstated all three men. George Jessup Jr. says there were bright spots between whites and blacks, like the day his father asked him to take over first aid training for black workers. None of the white instructors would do it.
I had a ball with those guys. Tell one little tale about one of the white foremen that thought first aid was a lot of nonsense, wouldn't take the course and so on. He and his wife and family were out on the edge of the reservoir and his child fell in the water. Black fella heard him holler and came over and reached over and pulled youngster up out of the water and did some artificial respiration. And the foreman didn't know how to thank him, and the black man told him, says, I work for this wonderful outfit over here. We're building this dam, and they gave me a course on how to do it. Ticker foreman was up at the office looking for the next course.
While labor and racial troubles were giving project managers headaches, land acquisition for the reservoir was bringing heartache to families whose homes and farms would soon be under Kentucky Lake.
Required 134,000 acres just for the reservoir and an additional 100,000 above the waterline for flood control purposes.
That's David Nickel. The West Kentucky Community and Technical College sociology professor is a member of the Between the Rivers Association, a group that advocates for the families relocated for the creation of Kentucky Lake and Lake Barkley. His family owned a farm on the north end of what is today land between the lakes.
TVA gives the low number of 2,600 families relocated for Kentucky Dam along both banks of the river. If you assume in the 1930s and 40s, average rural family had five people, which I think is probably a low estimate, that would be at least 13,000 individuals relocated just for Kentucky Dam. By the end of the 1930s, by 1940, TVA had already relocated more people than were removed by the Trail of Tears all through the Tennessee Valley. In his works, Arthur Morgan said over and over again that if the people relocated from TVA's dams didn't end up in a better condition than they were originally, then TVA had failed. His goal was to go in, TVA would buy up a block of land and set up these model villages on it and relocate the people into these villages, that you would better the farmers and relocate them on better farmland. You would have them trained from TVA on using the fertilizer. Everybody's lives would be improved from the process. Lilienthal wanted to make sure everybody was out of the way in time to start raising the water.
Nickel says that when David Lilienthal replaced Arthur Morgan as head of the Tennessee Valley Authority in 1941, the emphasis on improving the lives of the displaced ended.
You're going to be paying people as low a price as you can to keep the cost of the project down. And they're all going to have to relocate. So when you get a whole community, a whole population of people trying to find land to purchase at the same time, that drives the price of the land up in the surrounding area. So the chances that they're going to find equal value land to move to, it was almost impossible that that was ever going to happen. And then there was the problem they never did figure out how to deal with, which was a lot of the people were tenant farmers, which meant they didn't own any property. They're going to have to move, but they're not getting any compensation, any money to move with, to find some place to move to. And you're reducing the number of farms, so the odds of finding another tenant farm position are pretty small.
Nickel says the human cost was just as high as the dam's price tag.
Birmingham, Kentucky, which had, by the time Kentucky Dam Project came along, was down to a little over 300, if I remember right. And that town, there was little opposition to moving, and basically they just went away, and the entire town of Birmingham just is under the lake now. When the lake level's low, you can still see the tombstones from the cemetery at Birmingham.
Mm-hmm. just a lonely little river, but I have heard somebody say that someday you may sweep my home away. You keep going your way. I just got a cabin. Now you don't need my cabin.
Not all the work on the dam project involved construction or land clearing and acquisition. At TVA's inception, 30% of the general Tennessee Valley population suffered from malaria. Along the river, the rates doubled. The new Kentucky Reservoir threatened to make things worse. The inlets and swamps it would create would become mosquito breeding grounds. But University of Tennessee economist Dr. Larry Bray explains that TVA was prepared.
TVA partnered with the Alabama Department of Public Health, and they developed a biological way to control mosquitoes. And what they would do was, once they had the river system impounded, they of course eliminated a lot of the areas where mosquitoes could breed in. The biologists would watch the river, and when the mosquitoes would lay their eggs and the eggs would hatch into larvae, they would lower the river, trap them on the dirt, and they would die. They also instituted a program to teach people to use window screens. I heard a presentation once, and a gentleman said that they had used a little DDT in around the year 1950. But using all of these things, they totally wiped out malaria.
Malaria control efforts at Kentucky Lake also meant purchasing low-lying land for fill and installing dikes and pumps for backwater areas. The efforts cost over $2.5 million. Then came December 7th, 1941.
We interrupt this program to bring you a special news bulletin. The Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, by air, President Roosevelt has just announced. The attack also was made on all naval and military activities on the principal island of Oahu. We take you now to Washington.
War now overshadowed concerns about land acquisition and displaced people. The dam became a high priority. Its electricity was needed to power aluminum plants for the war effort. The work week went to 6 days, then to seven. And finally, on August 30th, 1944, Kentucky Dam was completed and its gates closed. 15 days later, its first generator went online. Murray became the first community in the region to get power from the new dam. The Four Rivers had gone electric. The next 12 months saw the passing of Franklin Roosevelt, the end of World War II, and the dawn of the atomic age. On October 10, 1945, with men still coming home from Europe and the Pacific, TVA and the Lower Tennessee Valley Association held a dedication ceremony for Kentucky Dam on the Marshall County Bank. It was a red letter day for the region.
President Truman, on a tour of Tennessee Valley areas, relaxes for a moment with one of his young constituents, just before moving on to Gilbertsville, Kentucky, for the dedication of a great new dam. Last of 16 erected by the Tennessee Valley Authority for the production of power and the rebuilding of this rich region.
WHAS, through its remote control facilities, presents the ceremonies attendant upon the dedication of the Kentucky Dam and a dedicatory address by the President of the United States. We take you now to Gilbertsville, Kentucky.
Good morning. This is Ray Edwards speaking to you from the site of the gigantic Kentucky Dam near Gilbertsville, Kentucky, 22 miles up the Tennessee River from Paducah, Kentucky, the junction point of the Ohio and Tennessee Rivers. Our WHAS microphones are set up at the end of the concrete section of this 8,400-foot dam overlooking the spillway area
As the assembled crowd craned their necks toward the speaker's platform, Senator Alvin Barkley introduced the guest of honor.
And it now gives me great pleasure, and it is a great honor, not only to welcome him here into West Kentucky, but to present him to you at this time, the President of the United States.
Senator Barkley, Governor Willis, Mr. Draffin, Congressman Gregory, Mr. Lilienthal and the Tennessee Valley Authority, ladies and gentlemen, it is now a matter of great pride to me to dedicate the 16th structure built by TVA, this great Kentucky dam. The system of dams across the Tennessee now puts under control of man a whole vast river and harnesses it to do his work. This has not yet happened to any other river. Here in this great valley, American enterprise and courage and skill have come through again with a genuine achievement. Ahead of us lies a great adventure in building even stronger the foundations of our beloved country. America will not hesitate to meet that challenge.
When we return, the dam meets the challenges of 9/11, the New Madrid Fault, and the digital age. You're listening to Kentucky Dam, Power for the People, a production of WKMS News. Welcome back to Kentucky Dam, Power for the People, from WKMS News. I'm Todd Hatton. Economic growth exploded in the Four Rivers in the decades following Kentucky Dam's completion. Industrial plants sprung up around Calvert City in the late 40s and 50s. The United States Atomic Energy Commission opened the Paducah Gaseous Diffusion Plant in 1952. TVA brought Shawnee Fossil Plant online in 1957. And in 1964, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers completed Kentucky's sister dam on the Cumberland, named for Vice President Alvin Barkley. While the dam's electricity helped bring industry to the shores of the Tennessee, the improved navigation it provided also allowed for the expansion of industry on the river. UT Knoxville economist Dr. Larry Bray explains the increase in traffic in terms of shipper savings, which totaled the money saved shipping goods on the river.
When I left TVA, the traffic there was about 50 million tons. So it rose from 2 million tons in 1930 to 50 million tons in 2006 or so. And at that time, the shipper savings was $500 million, so it went from $25 million to $500 million. Traffic's down a little bit now, down to about 38 million tons, but because like in 1930, a lot of the traffic on the Tennessee River is construction-related, and when you aren't building anything, you don't need to ship anything.
Along with the increase in commercial river traffic came a rise in the number of recreational boats on the water. Marinas and resorts appeared all along the 2,400 miles of shoreline from Marshall County in Kentucky south to within 5 miles of the Mississippi state line. One resort is unique. The former planned village that once housed hundreds of workers and engineers became Kentucky Dam Village State Resort Park in 1949. Kentucky Lake draws 17 million visitors and their tourism dollars each year. But perhaps the greatest impact of the different industries can be seen in Western Kentucky paychecks. Income in the region has risen from 30% at the national median in 1930 to 80% today. For the most part, Kentucky Dam looks as it did at its completion, with a few exceptions. Automobiles and trains no longer travel over it, and the visitor center is being renovated.
Hi,
right, so when we go back in, go in the powerhouse, we'll go down.
Inside the dam, the decor hasn't changed much either. The orange, pink, and green terrazzo tile floors shine under the fluorescent lights, and the air rumbles with the sounds from the generators, offices, and vents. Plant manager Bill Stallion, dressed in a casual but crisp TVA shirt and hard hat, takes us down to a fourth floor viewing deck to see the dam's heart, its five generators.
Generating capability of about 220 megawatts. And again, that depends upon the net head. The net head just means if I'm at this elevation on the lake, at say 360, and I'm at 300, for example, then I've got 60 foot ahead. And the more head, the more torque, the more torque, the more energy you can produce. That's the name of the game.
This is as far down as any approved visitor can go, but it didn't used to be that way.
In 1999-2000, there were no gates, there was no turnstile, there were no badges that had chips in them. The general public could walk out fifth floor deck and look at the spillway section. Nighttime, daytime, weekend, there were no restrictions whatsoever. September 11, 2001, changed all that. Within, I would say, a year, there were barbed wire fences and gates and turnstiles and badges, and it became a very, very serious thing to try to get into one of the plants. And we're under constant threat every day. I mean, we get emails, or I get emails, they've thwarted this or that or whatever.
Stallion says the most common threats are cyber and stem from TVA's centralized control of all its hydro facilities. They're monitored and controlled on and off-site by TVA technicians in Chattanooga, Tennessee.
Right now, Kentucky Hydro is one of four plants who are have to be NERC certified, NERC. They take a look at cyber-sensitive areas, what's called PSPs, physical security perimeters. So any place that you can hook into, hook a laptop into the computer and start and stop a unit or do damage to the unit is off-limits.
But those aren't the only kinds of threats Stallion has to watch out for. He says no matter what kind they are, TVA takes its security seriously.
I believe it was in 2009. Somebody left a cooler, just a real small little igloo cooler in a parking lot. And I jokingly said at the end of the day, I said, well, I wonder who left their worms out here. Of course, at the time we had TVA police on site. And they said, oh, don't touch it. And there was no cars around it. TVA police got involved, and they called the bomb squad from Paducah. And they came up, and they blew it to smithereens. I mean, they had a little robot. It was a huge ordeal. They were worms. But you never know.
One thing TVA does know is that Kentucky Dam sits in a seismic zone that is itself responsible for creating a lake, Real Foot, in northwest Tennessee. Stallion says he doesn't know how big of a quake the dam could withstand, but it's been rumored that it could handle 7 on the Richter scale. The dam's designers and engineers did provide a way to inspect the dam's foundation should a strong enough tremor happen. And Stallion became well acquainted with it after a 5.4 quake struck Vincennes, Indiana in 2008.
I got called out that night, and it was about 2 o'clock in the morning, and I came out, and me and two other gentlemen came out, and we walked the dam. We walked down in the spillway. There's actually a tunnel underneath all that, that walks all the way across there. You're on the floor of the lake. Anyway, we walked down through that. I think it's 100, I used to know exactly, I think it's 162 steps. It's not too bad going down, but when you start to come back up, if you're out of shape like I am, it takes a while to get back up. But we actually have to go down there and do a visual inspection.
Stallion says the dam suffered no appreciable damage. When he's not walking on the lake bottom, Stallion's day includes safety training, replying to 100-plus emails, making sure the dam is performing as designed, and handling whatever else Mother Nature's decided to throw at it.
Where we've been operating our units for probably 6 months nonstop. Last year, the drought had a direct impact on us because you don't have the water coming to us. You can't generate as much. You can't generate as often. We got down to one or two units for a week or two at a time. And every once in a while, they'd throw one on just because they needed the generation because the load was sagging somewhere else. But if we don't have water, the old saying, we're dead in the water. We can't generate. We've got to have water moving. We'd very seldom ever go to no generation at all because, again, you're looking at that 9-foot navigation channel. So you're wanting to maintain that river flow.
But the subsequent heavy winter precipitation turned the famine into more than a feast, changing Stallion's job from maintaining navigation to flood control. No matter, Stallion says Kentucky and her sister dams are ready for that too.
Tennessee River, not just Kentucky, but Tennessee, the TVA has averted just this January over $800 million of damage, the flood damage. So by them operating the dams and running the river right, and that's one of our goals.
Stallion says apart from annual maintenance to the floodgates and the 5 generators, there's not much more in the works for Kentucky Dam. He says there has been talk of adding a 6th generating unit, but TVA officials debate whether a new unit would be worth the millions in cost and the loss of a spillway gate. Today it may be hard to imagine our region without Kentucky Dam. It's a part of life, whether you hunt, fish, boat, hike, or just turn on a light switch. But a few remain who can't quite forget life before the dam, no matter the improvements. WKCTC professor David Nickel remembers one of them.
My aunt was, she lived to be, well, we buried her on her 100th birthday. When she was 86, she wrote a letter to me talking about all of that that had gone on and the part of the farm we lost from Kentucky Dam, everything that went on with it. And she said that every time she tries to talk about what was lost, people tell her, well, it's all water over the dam. But I say it's all under the dam water. She was a spunky lady. So I think it's not so much animosity as something more akin to grief about what was lost that most people will never even know was there. So I think it's probably a mistake to try to ask, well, was it a good thing or a bad thing? Because the answer is yes.
Kentucky Dam, Power for the People is a production of WKMS News. It was written and produced by Todd Hatton and Chad Lampe. Archival interviews with Thelbert Joyce, L.J. Horton, George Jessup Jr., Frank DePriest, Charles Barrett, Robert Moore, Mamie Evans, and Zelma White came from Murray State University's Jackson Purchase Oral History Project Collection, and we thank MSU librarian and archivist Dieter Ulrich, along with Wesley Bolin, for their help in bringing them to you. Our thanks also go to Scott Brooks of Tennessee Valley Authority's Public Relations and Kentucky Dam Plant Manager Bill Stallion for their generosity in providing access to Kentucky Dam and the TVA archives. And we thank West Kentucky Community and Technical College Associate Professor David Nickel, Ted Howard, Murray State History Professor Dr. Dwayne Bolin, University of Tennessee Economics Professor Dr. Larry Bray, and WUOT for their contributions and assistance. Audio from the 1945 dedication of Kentucky Dam was provided by the Kentucky Department of Libraries and Archives. The music you're hearing now was performed by Nathan Blake Lynn, Josh Coffey, and J.D. Wilkes. I've been your host, Todd Hatton. Thank you for listening.